blaze of red and blue lights filling all of my mirrors. The sirens didn't come on until a second later for some reason, the sound dopplering up and then pouncing on me, filling my legs, my chest, my head. I pulled over by nearly crashing into a high fence. My hands were quaking against the wheel. I was breathing so hard that I thought my lungs might pop. I heard shouting and slamming doors, and I saw shadows racing toward me, and I knew, before Sheriff Cole's face appeared above me, before the whole thing dissolved into noise and shoving and flashing lights, that here it was, finally, the punishment I'd been racing toward.
Edmund Wright's Journal, December 1. What a self-important old fool I've been. It was not I who was becoming more practiced at sustaining the episodes of inhabitation. It was the spirits who were becoming practiced at inhabiting me. It was they who longed to remain, gaining ever greater mastery of my mind and senses, until they could besiege me with the vision that would suit their ends. In my student days, I read of a species of caterpillar that was prone to a most frightful misfortune. This sorry caterpillar would on occasion be attacked by a small and vicious wasp who, in the course of his assault, would lay a great many eggs in the caterpillar's abdomen. The wasp's eggs would then proceed, by some chemical means, to control the caterpillar's movements, inducing it to gather precisely the type of nutriment they craved. Once the eggs had matured sufficiently, they would come pouring forth from the caterpillar's underbelly, a hellish horde. Thus do I, at the end of my researches, having spent all the fall playing host to spirits, find myself husked and destroyed.
Admittance materials, Northern Duchess Hospital. Welcome to Summers 11 North, a 26-bed acute care psychiatric unit where your friend or family member has been admitted. Visiting hours are daily from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., except on Tuesdays between 12 p.m. and 2 p.m. when all patients are required to attend community meeting. The next business day following the admission of your friend or family member, a social worker will be available between the hours of 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. to meet with you. If you cannot make this session, a social worker will contact you to schedule an alternative time. Please contact Dr. Gutman, see Staff Directory, page 2, immediately if your friend or family member expresses the idea of hurting himself or herself, hurting someone else, or running away from the hospital. If Dr. Gutman is unavailable, please ask to speak with the charge nurse or her/his designee and state that you have urgent patient information that must be acted upon immediately.
4. One of the staples of my fantasy life when I was at the height of my musical ambitions/delusions was the speech I'd give when I won my first major award. Sometimes this speech took place in a ballroom, where everybody looked up at me from round tables, setting down their silverware in charmed amazement. Sometimes it took place in an actual Grammy-style theater, where I jogged down the aisle and up the stage stairs, smiling in friendly fake surprise. A standard feature of these imaginary speeches, anyway, was that they contained a brief section on feeling humbled. How, while it might seem as if this were a moment for maximal ego inflation, this whole award-receiving experience had actually only made me more appreciative than ever of all the people whose help I couldn't have accomplished this without, and of just how much there still was for me to learn. I would now support a constitutional amendment, ordering anyone who claims to be humbled in this way to be transferred immediately to the fourth floor Summers Psychiatric Ward at Northern Duchess Hospital. To be humbled is to wake up wearing an unterrible plastic bracelet with your name on it, to To find out, you'll have to earn positive behavior points in order to buy combos from the vending machine. To sleep in a salmon-sheeted twin bed 5 feet from a 40-something stranger who cracks his knuckles and farts poisonously in his sleep. The specifics of how I came to enter the hospital are both tedious and depressing, so I won't go too much into them, except to say that if Sheriff Cole hadn't been in the car that pulled me over, and if it hadn't been for the understanding of Dutchess County 2nd District Judge Marilyn Everts, who, perfectly reasonably, deemed me a danger to myself, I would have ended up somewhere worse. The hospital was half an hour north of Hibernia, a big, gloomy campus of duckless ponds and half-empty parking lots. The buildings, there were three or four of them, were painted yellow and looked like haphazardly constructed college dorms, rows of windows and sliding glass front doors. My first thought, pulling in, was that it resembled the conference center in Connecticut where I'd once spent an ill-advised weekend listening to presentations about digital marketing for artists and entrepreneurs. Checking in, that first morning of forms and information sessions and intake interviews, was a bizarre, bleak, indoctrination-type experience. Complicated grief disorder, people kept impressing on me, is a diagnosable condition. What I'd been going through, they insisted, didn't have to do with Dr. Blythe's notes or Donna's lies or any cardboard box. This was grief. This was shock. This was despair. This was just how these things felt. I'd been, they said, the victim of a series of delusions. I shouldn't be thinking about Hannah's death while I was hospitalized. Shouldn't be trying to solve anything. My only job was to take my pills, to do the various therapies, and to wait for my mind's vital signs to stabilize. I was, in other words, supposed to accept not just that I'd lost Hannah. I'd also gone some ways toward losing my mind. The main thing that struck me those first few days, the thing other than the place's incredible, soul-corroding grimness, was how hard life was for the patients there, and how little there seemed to be that anyone could do about it. It would happen sometimes that a group of trainee nurses, or a few administrators from another hospital would sit in on a group, and the difference between the civilians in the room and the patients would be as stark and essential as the difference between a light bulb that's on and one that's off. Something was gone from the patients at Summers. Some flavor, some force. Life for the non-patients was full of gossip, interest, jokes, projects that might or might not come through. Life for the patients was an ordeal to be suffered through. Or if they could find the means, not suffered through. It terrified me to realize that I'd somehow slipped from the first category of person into the second. I had plenty of time for this kind of reflection. You know those intervals in life when your plane has been delayed 5 hours and you've already finished your book, or you're stuck in traffic so bad that you might as well turn the car off? Life in a psychiatric hospital, assuming you're well enough to retain any sense of time at all, is one of those intervals stretched out to fill every minute. I was, as a 5150, supposed to spend 7 weeks at Summers. This dictated the wing I was placed in and the privileges I was allowed. Visitors, yes. Day trips, no. Both of my parents came to see me in that first week, and their stated position, I suspected they'd been prepped by a social worker, was that I was doing the right thing. I was in exactly the right place, that all they cared about was me getting well. But they looked, both of them, as if they'd found me living in a dumpster. It had only been a couple of weeks since I'd last seen them, and, Jesus, Nick, what happened, was flashing on both of their faces. I'd lost weight. I hadn't shaved. I was wearing plaid pajama pants Sheriff Cole had bought for me. I must, in other words, have appeared to them just as horrifying as my fellow patients had initially appeared to me. When they left at the end of the hour, there was a whole complicated system of sign-in desks and doors that needed to be buzzed. I felt the gruesome adult equivalent of what I'd felt when they dropped me off at summer camp. These strangers are now my people. My roommate, our door was never allowed to be fully closed, was a man named Diego. Our bedroom was tile-floored, white-walled, anonymous in the way of rooms that see many unwell inhabitants. Diego was in the hospital because of a fight he'd had at his last job at an auto shop in Poughkeepsie. I couldn't get all the details. He spoke in bursts of vividness that didn't quite link up. But there had been a pair of jumper cables, an arrogant college boy, a call to the police. Diego's diagnosis of his own mental condition was, "I get sometimes so my thoughts don't make no sense." He had a short black ponytail and a bottomless supply of eucalyptus cough drops. And because he'd been hospitalized twice before, he acted as my mentor. "This is Linda. Good lady. Born in Nebraska or someplace. Her husband, normal dude, they're married for like 20 years. Turns out he's gay plus a crackhead, and he's emptying her bank account. One day, she goes to get money so she can take her mother to the doctor. Finds out she doesn't even own her house anymore. Over by the window, that's Steve. 22 years old. Tried to kill himself last year with a cord from an air conditioner. Except the cord snapped. Dude fell, broke both his feet. I got no beef with him, but some other dudes, they don't like the way he looks at people in group. This is Eileen. How you doing, sweetheart? She don't eat. She went one whole year before she came in here, didn't eat nothing but water and 5 pieces of popcorn a day. Now they got her with tubes. Who else? Oh, that's the professor. We call him that because he just sits around all day and reads. He don't even care what dude would read a cereal box. I seen him do better on Jeopardy than the guys who make 40,000. Hey, professor, how many rivers are in Africa? How many legs do ants have? There was, in other words, enough collective suffering at Summers to dissolve any of our individual misfortunes. After a week or so, my story, dead girlfriend, delusions, drunken car chase, became just another drop in the endless gray ocean. I would hear myself saying things like, "And so I broke in and stole her notes," and, "I found out she'd been thinking about breaking up with me when she died," and the other people in the circle would just nod, sigh, say, yeah, they'd had cousins who'd gone through things like that. Every Tuesday morning at 10:30, we had a coping skills group. Each week's session focused on a different patient, and my first week there was Diego's turn. He was telling the story of a fight he'd had with his sister's boyfriend. "Okay," Dr. Mittal said. "Okay." Dr. Mittal was a young Indian woman with dramatic eye makeup and an engagement ring. "Do you know what your thoughts were when he pushed you?" "I was thinking, what the fuck you do that for? I'm gonna cut you." "Okay, so," reaching over to write illegibly on her whiteboard, "what the blank did you do that for? I want to cut you. Is that accurate?"
"Yeah, that's it."
"And your feelings were anger, I think we can say. Would you say there was some fear in there?"
"I wasn't afraid of shit. He was afraid."
"Okay, so anger. Maybe some annoyance. Is that fair to say? And on an intensity scale, how would you rate these feelings? How angry were you?"
"Oh, way up here, like about to blow."
"Should we say a 7 or an 8? Now let's bring in the group and talk about some skillful things you could have done when you were feeling anger at a 7 or an 8.
"He could have breathed?"
Eileen said breathily.
"He could have bashed a guy in the teeth with his bike lock," Steve muttered.
"Okay, so let's talk about whether that would have been skillful. How do we define skillfulness in this context?"
"Effectively meeting our goals and values."
"And what are our goals and values in this situation?"
Diego said. "Not going to jail."
"Not going to jail. That's a good goal. Any others?"
"Not being the kind of dude who has to jack people when they get in his face."
"Nonviolence? Is that the value you're describing?"
"Yeah, non-violence. Other people can be getting all wild on you and you just say, you ain't even worth one drop of blood."
"And can anyone think of a behavior that might have served these goals and values?"
Not going to jail and non-violence?
No one said anything for a minute or two. These sessions, because of over-medication or just the strangeness of hospital culture, always contained long pockets of silence. And then, for the first time since I'd been there, the professor raised his hand.
"Would you mind if I went and found Nurse Carol?" he said. "I'm having an issue with my blood sugar. My cereal ran out at breakfast, and the only bananas they had were mush."
He talked with his hands by his mouth, rubbing his cheek through his beard. His notebook was bouncing in his lap.
"Go ahead, James," Dr. Mittal said.
The professor hurried out of the room, shaking his head as if to dislodge a fly. Diego, turning around in his chair, called out through the door,
"What? My story's not smart enough for you?"
Tuesdays and Thursdays, I had individual counseling with Dr. Mittal in the B hall. We met in one of the glass-walled rooms across from the TV area. Most rooms at Summers were glass-walled, in keeping with the student center panopticon vibe. We sat across a little round table from each other, close enough that I would sometimes accidentally bump her when I rearranged my legs. She wore her pantsuit. I wore my pajamas. A year ago, I'd think, she and I could have been colleagues meeting to plan a holiday party. Now she was keeping one eye on the emergency button. Dr. Mittal had told me in our first session that one of our main progress goals was going to be coming up with a good enough story of Hannah's death.
"Most traumatic deaths," she said, "are to some extent mysteries."
I rubbed Hannah's papers in my pocket, the pages now as soft as the fabric of my pajamas.
"Survivors often find it more comfortable, emotionally, to focus on solving the mystery, even if this activity is actually very unpleasant, rather than on facing whatever feelings they're having. So we're going to do our best to come up with a story that stays within the bounds of what we know, and then we're going to practice saying, good enough."
The story we came up with over a handful of dry-mouthed, silence-punctuated sessions was, I had been engaged to a woman with a history of mental instability, and the stresses of thinking about marriage, plus a new job and living situation, plus some unwise decisions about her medicine had pushed her into a crisis.
"This is good so far, Nick. You're doing great. I like that word, crisis. Keep going."
And so, one morning in November,
what about the things Hannah had told Dr. Blythe about the Kemps? "Well, she was clearly in great distress. Can you bring in experience from your own life? Does your thinking become more or less clear when you're extremely upset?"
And so one morning in November, although we couldn't know with 100% certainty if it had been an accident.
"Yes, good. 100% certainty is 100% impossible."
Hannah had gone out and walked into the river.
"What about the canoe, though?"
"Let's not get hung up on that. This might be one of those details that we'll never fully understand."
"And she'd drowned, whether or not she'd meant to."
"Good, yes."
"And what about her not leaving a note?"
"More than half of all suicides don't leave notes. Let's try not to speculate."
"And we'd found her body that afternoon, much too late to do any good. And the downward spiral portion of my life?"
"Can we rephrase that less judgmentally?"
"The recent, difficult portion of my life had begun." So, this was the patchy and unsatisfying version of events that it was now my job to accept. Whenever I found myself disappearing down a mental alleyway, whenever I found myself reading and rereading the list in my pocket, wondering what Hannah had meant, I was supposed to check in by focusing for 30 seconds on the sensations in my feet, and then I was supposed to consult what Dr. Mittal and I had written together in my notebook. The words Kemp and canoe and Donna and writers were all supposed to act as warning bells now, indicators that my thoughts had drifted off into the unverifiable. I could, with the help of diaphragmatic breathing, make room for the uncomfortable thoughts and feelings, but I didn't have to follow them. This all sounds culty and soft-headed as I write it out, but the truth is that I was sufficiently desperate for relief and sufficiently skeptical of my own judgment that I actually signed on to Dr. Mittal's approach most of the time. Hannah had died because some people's brain chemistry predisposes them to acts of self-destruction, and all the stories I'd been telling were clouds of fog around that simple fact. Go through anyone's papers after they die, and you'll find 50 things that don't add up, rabbit holes you could fall down. All but a tiny slice of the things that have ever happened, even to the people we love, we won't ever know about or understand. So this was how I spent my time. Feeling my feet, battling my brain, taking turns labeling one or another of the voices in my head as unreliable. And life in the hospital, medicated, joyless, airless, turned on. The institutional HVAC system roared and fell silent. Pancakes appeared and went cold in the cafeteria. I got used to the outside existing for me only as a series of brown grass and pavement landscapes seen through sealed windows. Needing to wait for a staff member to swipe an ID card in order to get from one hallway to another no longer felt remarkable. At some point, I'd even stopped noticing the slowness of everything. My inner settings had adjusted such that this was just life's tempo. I had group counseling and individual counseling, creative arts therapy, CBT for distress tolerance, relapse prevention, ask the doctor, roles and relationships. I was back in college, it occurred to me. A very unprestigious college. Only this time I was majoring in life. And one of my main professors, appropriately, was turning out to be the professor, James. He wasn't the patient I liked best. That was probably Linda, the heartbroken Nebraskan. But he was the one most capable of complex conversation, which acted as a vitality drip for me. At some point, a ritual had evolved, where he and I and a couple of other patients would gather every afternoon in the corner of the lounge farthest from the TV. The TV, usually tuned to the game show network, played incessantly, pitched so that you couldn't quite hear it if you wanted to, and couldn't quite ignore it if you didn't want to. The lounge was carpeted with heavy wooden tables and waxy potted plants. The chairs and couches had square cushions covered in scratchy red fabric. There were lines of masking tape on the floor to mark off the areas where we weren't allowed to go. This was our salon. The professor, who I would have guessed was in his late 50s, liked to sit in the chair closest to the radiator. He'd set down whatever book he happened to be reading. Once it was The Count of Monte Cristo, another time it was Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And he would talk with me and Linda, or me and Diego, about whatever was going through his mind. He had crooked yellow teeth and eyes that drooped in red-rimmed yolk sacks. He wore visibly stained khaki pants and two big sweatshirts. He had a gray beard that covered his face about as completely as leg hair covers a leg. He looked, honestly, like someone who masturbates in the bathroom of Port Authority. But he wasn't a pervert. He just wanted to talk. And then, just at the point when he thought he had to be winding down, he wanted to talk some more. For the pathological blatherer, the catatonically depressed are an ideal audience. Among the things he wanted to talk about, his exercise regimen. He didn't understand why people spent all this money on fancy gyms when you could just do what he did. A few squats, a couple of jumping jacks, a handful of those, what do you call it, with your arms, you were all set for the day. He also didn't understand how anyone could fail to see the war that was coming. Ice caps melt, here come new shipping routes, here come the Russian tankers, here comes Obama surrendering to everyone who comes into his field of vision. Why exactly the professor had been hospitalized was a subject he steered around. A new patient, a schizophrenic woman named Marianne, asked him point blank one afternoon, and he just sneered at her before going on about oil prices. He made occasional allusions to some sort of betrayal, and to a daughter who, whenever she visited, failed to bring him the right sort of snack bars. But that was as far as he went. He showed no interest in anyone else's stories. He didn't even come to group therapy most times. He kept the same kind of haughty curtain drawn around his life that the doctors did. Most of the patients didn't seem to mind this. Oracles are meant to be inscrutable. "What do you think?" Diego asked him one day. "About Bloomberg. How come the dude got so rich, but we still got people can't even fit in the shelters?" The professor rocked in his chair, then gave a long answer involving the Bilderberg group.
"Why can't we just suck pollution out of the air with a giant vacuum?" asked Linda. "You put it on the floor and all the dirt comes up. Why can't you just point it up to the sky?"
"You had to understand about solenoid valves and bioaerosols," the professor explained. I, though, because of genuine curiosity or an inkling I didn't understand, couldn't leave the question of what he was doing here alone. I knew I wouldn't be able to get at it directly. So instead, I developed a game of trying to bait him into revealing more about himself than he meant to. "Boy, did I know a thing or two about not being able to trust people," I'd suggest. Or, "A guy as smart as him, he must have gone to a pretty good school. Today, colleges were just diploma factories, of course, but back when he went, it must have been different, right?" But his river of talk was not to be diverted. My guess, if you'd asked me, and this is maybe part of why I was so interested, was that he'd done something violent. He'd once referred to Vietnam in a way that made me think he'd fought there, and he had the kind of schlubbiness plus self-regard that made it easy to picture him plotting against his superiors, being convinced that he alone was defending some important truth. I'd seen him once lose his temper with one of the social workers, red-faced, nostrils flared, thumping his fist against the shatterproof glass. I could imagine him in a standoff at an office complex, or standing with a butcher's knife over his bloodied boss. Dr. Mittal was right. Exploring a mystery, however remote, was infinitely more appealing than dwelling on how I felt. And then, one afternoon, the professor and I were the only ones in the lounge, both sipping cups of lukewarm coffee. He diverted the river for me. I don't know exactly what I'd said to bring this about. He may just have come to the mistaken conclusion after all these conversations that I was someone he could trust. "I usually don't get into the story of why I'm here," he said. "Of course not," I said, leaning forward. "It's the kind of thing where you give somebody the littlest bit of an idea, they go running off to the nurses. Next thing you know, you're doped up on Seroquel, can barely string a sentence together. I'm working on a memoir. Memoir slash treatise. Major interest from a couple of places. Stuff already in the works. So I can't have, you know, Diego going around telling everybody my story." "No need to explain to me about effing Diego, please. But I'll tell you a little about it. You seem like the literary type. Have you read much spiritualism? About metempsychosis? Maybe Piper? That's how I see my book. If I can get the public to actually take a look at this stuff, really understand what I'm saying, then I'm not going to be in a hospital. I'm going to have my name on a hospital, if you get what I'm saying. Major league sales potential, if I get the time to actually write the thing." "So the book's about stuff you've experienced then, or is it more?"
"The place where I used to work, I can't tell you because you better believe I'm suing their asses. Anyway, where I used to work, they should have welcomed this kind of stuff. They should have been shouting it from the rooftops. Could have been their book. But instead, you've got people calling my phone in the middle of the night. You've got people telling me I'm neglecting my duties, planting viruses on my computer. It's exactly the same thing I was telling you about with the Navy, how you get an institution so devoted to protecting itself that it forgets why it..."
And this, for whatever reason, was the moment when the coin finally dropped into my mental slot. The sensation was more like getting a joke than like learning a fact. So this was why I'd been drawn to the professor. This was why I'd spent all these hours peering at him, listening to him, pondering him. Some part of me, the part that ran my mind's filing system deep in the sub-basement, must have recognized him all along. You didn't used to work at a historic house museum, did you? I said. He was, for the first time since I'd met him, struck dumb. I pulled Hannah's papers out of my pocket and started to unfold them.
Who wrote this?
He finally said, looking them over.
Your girlfriend wrote this?
James. Jim. So now I'd met the Wright House's previous caretaker. Jim told me his story, far less cogently than I'm going to recount it here, over a series of coffee-addled afternoons in the lounge. Sometimes he'd talk for an hour without a break. Sometimes he'd stop after just a few minutes, muttering about a headache, and spend the rest of the afternoon staring out into the hospital courtyard. I continued on those days to see Dr. Mittal, to sit mouthing platitudes in various configurations of chairs. But I could feel from that first moment of recognizing Jim that something was happening to me, that a match had been struck somewhere way down in the depths. Anyway, Jim's story. He'd been the director of the Wright Museum for almost 10 years, from the early 2000s until a few months before Hannah and I moved in. The first 7 or 8 years of his tenure had been completely unremarkable, or no more remarkable than being the director of any other tiny, failing history museum would have been. Budget cuts, fundraising schemes, meetings with the local school board. He lived at the museum alone.
My wife had the good sense to divorce me before I started on any of this.
He cooked for himself using herbs from the garden plot. He bickered with Donna and planned weekend events and talked what few visitors the museum had into a state of baffled submission. At night, he read 700-page library books about the tribal history of the Hudson Valley. Then, at some point in his 7th or 8th year at the house, something strange had happened.
You've got to understand, this was a winter when I was having a lot of health problems. Inner ear stuff, lung stuff, stomach stuff. So I was unusually susceptible.
He was lying in bed one night, keeping himself awake with his coughing, when he suddenly realized that someone was standing in his room watching him.
The room? Well, you know how dark the room is, and to get in there you would have to... But I could feel the person, exactly the same as I can feel you. So I was trying to decide what to do. Should I sit up, or shout something, or should I just lie there pretending to be asleep? When it happened. The only way I can describe it is, the person, whatever it was, it leapt on me. But instead of attacking me, instead of doing anything like that, it just sunk into me. So now I was just lying there in the dark again.
But the thoughts he found himself thinking now, the memories he found himself having, they weren't his. They belonged to someone else. Something, someone, was inside him now. And it wasn't until 4 or 5 in the morning, that night was just endless, endless, that he realized who that someone was. Edmund Wright. Jim didn't tell anyone what had happened to him.
To be honest, I was afraid I was losing my fucking mind.
He had, of course, known that there was some loopy, ghost-related stuff in Edmund Wright's past, and he'd indulged the writers about it, but he'd never taken it seriously himself. He'd always assumed, the way almost everyone assumed, that this was Conan Doyle with his fairies stuff. A great mind under the influence of grief and maybe some 19th century drugs, coming unglued. But now, after the episode in his bed, Jim became convinced that there was more to it than that. That Wright had not only studied spirits, but become one.
And I got obsessed. Writing out accounts of what had happened to me, seeing if I could get it to happen again. Reading everything I could get my hands on, writing letters to people who I thought might have some old papers in their attics about this stuff.
But he'd only been at it for a couple of weeks when he ran into a roadblock. As soon as Donna found out what kind of research she was doing,
I went to the bathroom and I left a goddamn browser window open.
She started going after him.
This woman, you've got to understand, she is not well. She is unhealthily fixated on. She's obsessed with the fact that Edmund Wright was her great-great-whatever he was. And if she finds out that anyone's even having a thought that she thinks might hurt Wright's reputation, she launches a federal investigation.
Butch tried to defend him. Butch actually knows much more about this stuff than he lets on. He knew the Kemps growing up, knew them personally. But even together, Butch and Jim were no match for Donna. She convinced the board that Jim wasn't well, and that they needed to decrease his responsibilities. She started messing with the heat in the museum. She told Lydia Gibbons, "That absolute joke of a human being," who was the authority on all things right, to send Jim a letter explaining how absurd his line of inquiry was. But in the meantime, and by this point in the telling, Jim was gnawing at his nails so vigorously that one of them had started to bleed. He was continuing to make discoveries about the spirit world. Donna could reduce his responsibilities. She could ruin his reputation, but she couldn't control what he did at night when he was alone in the museum. Wright's spirit had entered him a few more times in the weeks since it had first happened. He could feel when he was getting ready for bed whether the conditions were right for it, and he'd started to develop more control of the experience. He could now remember, for instance, on the mornings after his inhabitations, exactly what he'd experienced. It had mostly been a single scene, Jim said. Edmund Wright, alone at the desk in his study, drinking something bitter from a small blue bottle and then slowly losing consciousness. This, when Wright was inhabiting him, was what he would experience over and over. And he discovered other things, too. For instance, that he could write down the story of Wright's death while he experienced it. And that Wright was just one of the spirits in the house. He felt himself inhabited one night by a woman he was fairly sure was Jan Kemp. Another time, he thought it was a cat who'd died years before in the basement. Every living being who'd ever been killed in the house was there, he said. This, he reached over and flicked my pocket, is what your girlfriend was up to with her list. But that wasn't all. Spirits, he said, do more than just make you relive their deaths. That's just what they do while they're getting used to you as a vehicle. Once they're comfortable inside you, they start playing your mind like an instrument. They show you visions, horrible ones, even things from your own life. During those nights of being inhabited, he re-experienced a childhood memory of plucking the legs off a spider. He saw himself as an old man, choking on his own tongue. For spirits, he realized, the living were like books on a shelf, readable from the first page to the last. By this point, Jim said, he was figuring it's either the Nobel Prize or a straitjacket for me, because these inhabitations, they were lasting longer and longer. I was piecing together whole theories, which people become spirits and where they are, and I'm getting frantic, worrying that someone else discovered this stuff and is going to beat me to it. And then I realize, I was up there in the storage room going through some papers one night, I realized that someone did beat me to it. All of it. By about a century and a half. Edmund Wright. Because Jim had discovered that winter that there were large and suspicious gaps in Edmund Wright's official papers. You ask Lydia Gibbons. You ask Donna. You look in the published works. You'd think spirits were just one of Wright's little side interests, like the thing with cross-fertilizing carrots. It's bullshit. The truth is, he spent years on this. He wrote a letter to William James calling this the work of his life. Sometimes in the original copies of Wright's journals, Jim explained, there would be a reference to months Wright had spent trying to solve some particular spirit-related problem. But if he went back and tried to find those months of notes, they would just be gone. Same deal with the letters. Certain pages didn't even look like they were in Wright's handwriting. Somebody, I think it's got to be his wife, went through and tossed almost every word he ever wrote about ghosts, about spirit writing, all of it, right in the fireplace. The stuff that I found is just the tip of the iceberg. And whoever it was left just enough so we'd think we had the whole picture. Completely unconscionable. Worst crime against intellectual history since the burning of the Library of Alexandria. And Jim thought he knew why Wright's wife would have wanted to hide what Wright had been working on. Wright hadn't died of accidental poisoning, the way the Lydia Gibbonses of the world would have you believe. He died because the spirits had killed him. That is, they'd shown him something so awful that Wright hadn't been able to bear it and had killed himself. This is what spirits do. This is what they're after with the visions they show you. They want you dead, so they can get reincarnated in your place. That's how they get free. They probably would have killed Jim, too, if his health hadn't fallen apart. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. I was hardly ever leaving the museum. He'd develop holes in the lining of his stomach, he said. Plus, his hip was crumbling, and the problem with his ears had changed, so that now, in addition to being dizzy all the time, he heard the sound of rushing water whenever he stood up. Except I couldn't take time out to go to the doctor, because a doctor would tell me to take a break from the museum. He was right on the cusp of something, he felt, just days away from discovering the vision that had killed Wright and Jan Kemp. He had more or less given up on running the museum to pursue this question. By this point, spirits were coming into him every night. When he got so sick that he passed out on the way to the bathroom and cracked his skull on the toilet tank. When Donna found him in the morning, she thought he was dead. His eyes were half open, his tongue was hanging out, blood was all over the tiles. But he wasn't dead, and the doctors in Poughkeepsie, once they'd cleaned him up and tested him for everything they could think of, told him there wasn't anything physically wrong with him other than high blood pressure and a sinus infection. He was admitted to Summers on a Sunday afternoon, officially terminated by the Wright House on Monday morning. No matter what he said, the doctors wouldn't let him have his papers from the museum. He started taking half a milligram of Haldol 3 times daily, plus 8 milligrams of Rosarum for sleep. He'd been here babbling to his fellow patients, scribbling notes for his memoirs with a felt-tipped pen ever since. I can't explain how hearing all this affected me exactly. Can't reconstruct the moment when I went from listening to him as a skeptic to listening to him as a potential disciple. Except to say that I was, by the time he finished, shivering to the base of my spine, and not from caffeine poisoning. Hannah's list was in my sweaty hands. Monday, woman on bridge. Tuesday, bird on porch. Thursday, boy in wheel. Saturday, cat in basement. I had, I felt, arrived at the point where I needed to make a choice. I could believe that what I'd heard was just a Russian nesting doll of insanity, that Jim lived inside Wright's craziness, and that Hannah, thanks to bad luck and some organic predisposition, had come to live inside Jim's. Or I could believe, at the risk of becoming the innermost doll myself, that Jim, and so Hannah, had glimpsed something real. And that all the work I'd done in the hospital was just a complicated means of rejecting the stray bits of oddity that had been begging me to assemble them since Hannah's death. "Your girlfriend," Jim said. "It sounds like she was following right in my footsteps. Those papers you've got, they would have been the least of it. You said she was always writing in a notebook, right? That's the motherlode. She probably would have tried to hide it. She wouldn't have wanted Donna to find it. Maybe not even you. That's what you've got to find." I sat silent for a few seconds. What does it mean when you say spirits want to get free? Free from what? From what? From not having a body. From reliving their deaths over and over. It's got to be agony. I nodded numbly. So this was how grief-sick widowers ended up signing over their life savings to psychics on the Lower East Side. This was how otherwise intelligent people came to fill their houses with quartz crystals and sage bundles. If I could, by taking Hannah too seriously now, make up for having failed to take her seriously enough in the fall, then I was ready to toss away my sanity like a crumpled dollar bill. I cleared my throat and leaned so close to Jim that our knees were touching. "Do you know if anyone's ever broken out of here?" I said.
From Lydia Gibbons, Edmund Wright, A Life. Published by the Dutchess County Historical Society, Notable Figures Series. That Wright was, by the middle of that winter, in a state of great despondency, is indisputable. Producing fewer and fewer pages, beset as ever by money troubles, he had turned once again for relief to that reliable friend, laudanum. It is the bitterest of ironies that Wright, whose career had been built on scrupulous, experimental practices, would be undone by something so trivial as a routine mismeasurement.
Summer, 2069, New Jersey, age 88. You are sitting in the sun by the window where they've left your chair. You start to reach for your glass of wine, but your hand is shaking. Lately you've been dropping things, pens, glasses, silverware. Your sister has been talking without taking a breath. Now she asks, "Do you remember Denise?" You tell her, "Yes, of course." You smile. That seems to satisfy her. You reach again for the glass, but your fingers won't open. They seem not to belong to you. Your sister raises her eyebrows, says, "You really do seem so much better." She takes a handful of almonds, drops them in her mouth. You smile again, say what you'd really like is to be out of this chair, and you don't mention the night last week when you fell from the bed, the floor rushing up to meet you, the dark crawl to the phone, the rest on the carpet, and how you had never until that second, unable to move your arms or call for help or lift your head, you had never understood before just what it meant to be alone.
Incident Report, Department of Security, Northern Dutchess Hospital. Name, print, Peter H. Israel. Pass number, 123102. Security Incident Number E-32-1250-15. Time of report, 1725. Supervisor notified, yes. Time notified, 1735. Incident Report Details. I was notified by hospital staff over the radio to check the emergency exit door in the lounge because a maintenance worker had reported seeing it open. Upon checking the door, it was open. After consulting Officer Clary, I declared an E-2202 and followed protocol, contacting Dr. Gutman via radio, unavailable. Officer Clary asked me to assist him plus staff in conducting headcount. 25 of 26 Summers patients were accounted for. Missing patient concluded to be Nicholas Barron, room 314, age 30, admit date 12/14. Conducted brief search of ward plus stairwells plus hospital perimeter, after which Officer Clary instructed me to notify Dutchess County PD, send Barron's patient ID photo plus info. I did so, 1655 to 1700. I then assisted Officer Clary, plus staff conducting E-2202 patient interviews, 1700 to 1815. Notes attached. Condition resolved? No. Further comments. In my opinion, James McLaren, room 302, and Diego Ortiz, room 314, should receive extra questioning.
Part 3. 1. Breaking out of Northern Dutchess Hospital turns out to require approximately the same level of ingenuity it takes to be admitted to it. For almost a week, Jim and I, with Diego as our third wheel, played Escape from Alcatraz, whispering at the bathroom sinks, watching the security guards on their afternoon rounds, speaking in code. SHU meant ID badge. Bobby was Sean, the guard whose card we'd decided it would be the easiest to steal. The actual escape took all of 15 minutes, and except for the presence of one startled nurse's aide vaping at the bottom of a stairwell, went off without a hitch. Signs that say, "Emergency exit alarm will sound," very rarely mean what they say. Bystanders who see that something is off tend, especially in a place as brimming with staff as a hospital, to assume that someone else will be the one to deal with it. It was 5 o'clock when I emerged panting into the parking lot slash loading dock behind Building 3. It was already dark out, raining half-heartedly. All I had with me were my toothbrush and a few pairs of underwear and socks, all wrapped hobo style in an old sweatshirt of Hannah's. There was no siren blaring, no policeman shouting into his bullhorn from a guard tower. Just the rain on the pavement and a couple of distant cars honking. On one side of the parking lot was a stand of bare trees. On the other was a windowless brick building that looked like it might house an incinerator. The air, just the quantity of it that was available to me as I set off along one of the empty exit roads, felt like a massive black lake. I should say here that my faith, my conviction that Hannah and so Jim and so Wright were non-delusional, had begun to waver in the days before I left the hospital, so I had, in order to maintain what remained of my self-respect, started building myself an internal cover story. It wasn't necessarily, I'd begun to tell myself, that I believed in the truth of whatever Hannah thought she had discovered. It was just that I wouldn't understand how she died unless I understood exactly what she thought she'd discovered. So I wasn't, by returning to Wright, proving that I'd had a mental breakdown. I was conducting a psychological investigation of a crime scene. In her notebook, I'd find the story that really would be good enough. My first civilian stop was at a Dunkin' Donuts a quarter mile south of the hospital on Route 9. This was in a strip mall featuring a GNC and a vacant, ghost-lettered Price Chopper. Being any sort of fugitive makes even ordinary sentences, "glazed please," sound squirrely. The Bluetooth-wearing man behind the cash register didn't look up at me, though. I don't think he could have identified me in a lineup of two. I inhaled half a dozen donut holes there on the sidewalk, working my lips over the wrinkled wax paper like a giraffe. And then, from what must have been the last working payphone in Dutchess County, I collect-called my dad. A minivan pulled past while I stood shivering, waiting for the call to connect, and I did my best, despite the pajama pants and sandals, to look as if I were conducting a piece of ordinary business, maybe calling my wife to see if I should pick up some eggs. I'd put Hannah's sweatshirt on over my t-shirt, which didn't help in my quest to look inconspicuous. It strained over my chest and shoulders and only went down to my belly button. But the temperature was dropping, and the rain had become mixed with something like flecks of Slurpee. "Hello? Nick?" My dad's voice overlapped with the robot operator saying that the charges had been accepted. I told my dad, turning my back to the parking lot while I spoke, about having left the hospital, about needing to go take care of something. I didn't use the words escape or Hannah or, needless to say, ghosts. "What are you doing? You need to be in the hospital. They were helping you. Where are you? Call them up and tell them you made a mistake." "I'm not going back. I'm just calling because the police are going to call and I don't want you to freak out. Don't tell them you talked to me." "Jesus, Nick. I'm asking you. Just say you have no idea. And I need you to call Mom and tell her the same thing, okay? Can you do that? Just tell her that I'm fine." I could see him taking off his glasses, massaging his forehead with his fingertips. "Well, tell me where you are, at least. I can call someone to pick you up. They can bring you wherever you need to go." "I'm fine. Just remember to call Mom, okay?" He was silent for a second. I wondered if he was calling the hospital on the other line. And when he spoke again, he sounded 100 years old. "How did this happen?" "I just walked out. It's not like there's a moat." "But how did it come to this? You were getting help. And now you're running away from the hospital, the police." "I don't know what to say," I told him. "My life hasn't been going exactly how I want it to. I need to hang up." It only took 45 minutes for me to find my way from the strip mall to the train tracks. The commuter rails that crisscross the Hudson Valley are a godsend to anyone whose circumstances require them to navigate long distances on foot without the aid of a map. My plan, hatched at the public computer in the hospital lounge with the browser in incognito mode, was to walk 15 miles north along the tracks to the Wasaic station and then to let half-familiarity and road signs steer me to Hibernia. The tracks, where I joined them, were rusty and spottily lit, set along the spine of a long mound of gravel. I walked 10 or so feet from the tracks, in a little gully by the edge of the woods, stopping every few minutes to pull gravel or a twig bit out of my sandals. By the time I'd been walking for an hour or so, two trains had clattered past, each one consisting of literally countless massive cars. The sleet had picked up to the point that Hannah's sweatshirt was plastered to my shoulders, and the socks and underwear in my hands were as soaked as if I'd just pulled them out of the washing machine. There were ice chips in my pants and in the neck of my sweatshirt. The occasional platforms I passed were like small towns along an endless highway. Each one held a cluster of umbrella-wielding commuters who seemed to be not just in better circumstances than mine, but in a better universe. I felt like a filthy Russian soldier marching to Siberia. I felt like a dog who's broken hugely, catastrophically free. I had started by the time I passed the Pauling station, carrying on a scattered, non-linear conversation, half with myself, half with Hannah. My lips were moving, but the sounds coming out were less than words. "What happened?" I mumbled. "Where did you go? Why didn't you teach me how to find you there?" It was dark enough now, and it had been long enough since a train had gone by that I had started to suspect, incoherently, that I had somehow missed a fork and wandered off along some defunct set of tracks. My mind had entered that unreliable, sleep-adjacent state in which it seemed possible I might have hallucinated the entire walk. I was a few minutes past Dover Plains. This was the most crowded platform I'd seen yet. When this unreliability cleared away, or deepened, to produce the sensation that someone was following me, I could hear footsteps crunching gingerly along behind me, and when I stopped to listen to them, they would stop, replaced by the sound of someone breathing shallowly. Nothing was visible behind me except an ominous murk. I imagined a state trooper, newish on the job, creeping along with one hand on his weapon. I imagined a mountain lion with razor teeth and worn velvet paws. Nothing connects you to your prey animal past like a bout of outdoor paranoia. I could practically feel my nostrils twitching. When the sense of huntedness became intolerable, I ran a few feet from the tracks and walked the next mile or two through dark brambles farther from the gravel and the light. Thorn bushes looped along the ground like barbed wire. Tree branches kept appearing at perfect face-whapping height. I was convinced with every squelching step I took that at any moment a policeman's shouting or an animal's jaws were going to swallow me up. And I wasn't at all sure that either of these would be a worse fate than just continuing to feel the way I felt. "Keep walking, keep walking, keep walking." A train roared past, startling me and setting off a serrated scrape of pain along the back of my skull. I was far enough into the woods now, and it was dark enough that I could only tell if the liquid on my cheek was water or blood by tasting it. The part of me, already small, that had any faith whatsoever in the wisdom of what I was doing, was shrinking toward non-existence. When I finally saw the Wasaic platform, a yellow-lit oasis half-glimpsed through dark brambles, I had just been trying to decide whether it would make more sense for me to lie down here or to go off in search of a phone to call the hospital. Long walks aren't over until you've spent a few minutes convinced that you may, instead of finishing, just have to die. I staggered, soaking, out of the woods and across the tracks, having glanced both ways to make sure I was going to be neither killed nor ambushed. Then I climbed, like Sasquatch hauling himself out of a swimming pool, up onto the empty and unlit end of the platform. A woman in a silver raincoat at the far end of the platform either saw me or just happened to tilt her head in my direction. The PA announcement implored us all to keep an eye on our belongings. I hurried down the stairs into the parking lot and out onto the sidewalk next to Deep Hollow Road. If they were going to catch you, they would have already caught you. Manhunts are for terrorists and axe murderers. They probably haven't even noticed that you're gone. Deep Hollow led to 22, led to 44, led to 82, led, after what must have been a couple of hours, to landmarks I actually recognized. Williams Lumber was closed, and its Pepsi machine was unplugged. The billboard for Hudson Valley Toyota looked like someone